I've always been confused about Jesus being God and Jesus being man. On one hand, it seemed like such a comfort that he would be a man like myself, and yet he is a sinless individual. How could he possibly identify with me, with my life?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
You know, Jack, I think we're asking people to work really hard in listening to this show. Somebody came up to me yesterday in church and said they'd listened to our program, and they said, gosh, you guys really make me think. I don't know if I know how to think that hard. And, you know, I think that's true. I don't think that we work really hard in our culture to think really hard. It's a hard job, even as I'm sitting here today. And sometimes when I sit in my counseling office, I realize that I really have to gear myself up to keep my mind in gear, keep my mind going, keep trying, rather than just to kind of let it go and let it kind of space out. It does take work to stay with and try to follow the concepts that we're trying to communicate to people. Do you ever find that true of yourself, that you just kind of want to disengage and kind of space out?
Oh, yeah. I just get my brain tired. That happens to me.
It's a real discipline, especially when you are brain tired.
It's so much a part of my life and my occupation, my vocation, that when I enter into the process, it becomes relatively straightforward for me. But when I want to crash, I want to crash, and when I don't want to think any longer, I don't want to think any longer.
Yeah, but you have really disciplined yourself, and I think I have too, to really keep on track with our thoughts. For me and my counseling, I really have to stay on track all the time with what people are saying and really not take a break. So, for example, at the end of the day, I remember last week my husband came up to me and said, would you like to do something on Saturday night? And he was talking about it. And I remember thinking, I can't even think about this. And he goes, Christine, like, where are you? And it's like, I wasn't there. I feel like sometimes I've exceeded the use of all my brain cells, and there's just nothing left because I work so hard for so long, keeping track with every movement, with every gesture, with every voice intonation, with every trying to play. It's like playing chess or three different games of chess at the same time and trying to keep up with all of them. And really the point that I'm trying to make here is I really would encourage you, our listeners, to try and stay with us. I know sometimes the concepts are difficult, perhaps not presented in a way that people might be used to having them presented, and it's easy just to kind of check out. Especially today, we're talking about, in our series, Understanding Key Biblical Concepts, we're trying to understand Jesus as the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, the Son of Man. And last week, we were talking about the concept of our personal relationship with Jesus. And you said, Jack, that, and I'm going to put this one on you because I think it's such a radical thing to say in our in the church today, is that our a personal relationship with Jesus is not what it's all about.
Yeah, at least as we typically understand it. I suppose, to be clear, Jesus is a person, I am a person. As my king, I relate to him, and he relates to me in a particular relationship. So we have persons relating to one another. I guess that's a personal relationship. But we have a certain image of what that is, and I think we need to redefine that and be clear as to what the nature of that relationship is.
Well, let's talk about the image, because I don't think it has to do with me relating. I don't think that's the... I don't first go to thinking about Jesus as my king. In fact, it's really hard, we were making the point last week also, to even think about a king as a United States citizen.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a king, we have a democracy. And so to even try and understand the king concept is something we have to kind of take time to do. It is easier for us, and I think what I have learned throughout my Christianity, or a lot of it, at least early on, was that Jesus was my friend, that he was my intimate, somebody that I could talk to. He would listen to me and maybe grant me what I wanted. He would give me everything I wanted. He would give me the desires of my heart, which I defined as the desires that I wanted, rather than God remaking my heart to have me desire what he wants for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jack, I kind of said real briefly what a personal relationship, as I see it defined in the church today, is. How do you see it defined?
Well, as I was raised in a church culture, it seems to me that the view I inherited, and whether I made this up or whether it was what people believed around me, I don't know that I can say, but I came to understand that my walk with God, my walk with Jesus, was a kind of state of consciousness that I attained to. I never would have used that language. It sounded too Buddhist, too Eastern. But that's what it was. Is a walk where I never lost sight of the reality and presence and
feeling of Jesus.
Yeah, that I could feel Jesus being with me, and we'd call that fellowship. I mean,
yeah.
That's the term that we use to describe that. I was in fellowship with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And what I meant by being in fellowship with him is a certain kind of harmonious, a state of consciousness of all being well between me and Jesus, Jesus being present, Jesus being real, Jesus being available to me, no alienation between me and Jesus. And that was the sum and substance of what my spirituality and of what my faith was all about, is to maintain and repair and keep healthy that relationship.
Yeah, that's good job, Jack. You said it much better than I did. And I hear a lot of people now being sad that they don't have what you've just described. They might say, people in my church all have this. They have this unique, intimate, personal relationship with Jesus that's ongoing, and they're feeling good about it. But I don't feel good about it. In fact, I feel scared sometimes, or I feel lonely, or I'm not sure I even have a relationship with Jesus because I don't have this intimacy that they're describing.
Right.
And I think people, I know that people really despair because of that.
The point that I want to make is that I don't think anybody has that relationship that I just described. I thought for years that I did, but I eventually came to recognize I was concocting this thing. I was manufacturing this thing. This was a figment of my imagination. The real Jesus who really exists didn't ever go away. The real Jesus who really exists remained my Lord, whether I was conscious of it or not, whether I felt it or not, regardless of my emotional, psychological state of consciousness. None of that really mattered to the reality of the Jesus who is my Lord.
Which is really freeing, isn't it?
Because it is, ultimately, yeah.
Because I don't have to conjure up some kind of a feeling or have a particular state of mind, but Jesus is just there.
Right. And he's, yeah, he's there, he's my Savior, he's my Lord, he's my King, he is the Son of God, and he controls my entire life and destiny, ultimately. And that just doesn't go away. I mean, that's just the constant bedrock reality of our lives.
He just is going to take care of me.
Yeah.
It's kind of how, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it's kind of how I feel about my children. As long as I'm alive, I just am going to love them. It doesn't matter if they feel close to me. In fact, I have a couple of sons that are teenagers, and what they're trying to work at is becoming their own independent selves. They want to have their own lives. They want to go in their own direction, and they really don't want a lot of input from me. Money, that's okay, but not a lot of other input, and which I think is appropriate for their developmental state, or their developmental stage, not state. But the reality remains that I am still there. I am behind them far more than they know, and they need me far more than they know. But it isn't dependent on them deciding that they're going to somehow get it from me. It's just there.
Mm-hmm. But even that's a little bit different than my experience with Jesus, because there I wasn't just having a variable relationship with the Jesus that really is there. I was actually kind of conjuring up a Jesus who wasn't there at all, who wasn't even really the real Jesus. I was kind of creating a Jesus out of the figment of my imagination and...
Perhaps out of the experience of your life. And I think that's where lots of our understanding of Jesus comes from. We're talking about a relationship with God, or a relationship then with Jesus. Jesus sounds very human, very personal. In fact, I know people named Jesus. And so what do I have? I have a relationship where I walk with him, I talk with him, I'm comforted by him, I'm around him all the time, and I'm thinking about him. My experience gives me this picture of a relationship with Jesus. And I'm not used to taking the Bible and making it define my experience. It's so much easier for me to define my experience through my experience.
Is this what you're talking about? Let me give you an example.
Did I lose you?
Maybe, I'm not sure. But, well, you give me an example, and then I'll...
Oh, that's a cop-out. Oh, let's see.
What do you mean by through your experience?
I think it's pretty simple. It's I have an experience of what relationship is like. Before I was married, I had an experience of friendships that I really liked. So when I thought about a personal relationship with Jesus, well, I thought about, it just naturally comes from my experience with relationships.
So this Jesus is your ideal friend, then he becomes your...
The perfect friend, the great friend, the friend that's always on my side, the friend that wants the best for me, and the friend that probably wants the best for me according to what I think is best for me. Because after all, I think in our sinful state, we usually think, I know the best for me. I am the center of the world, and I can figure it out. Now, I don't think I would say that directly in regard to my relationship with Jesus. I would say he knows the best for me. But again, I think it's defined by my experience that says, I kind of know what's better.
Yeah.
I'm the one that's best on my side.
Right. Yeah, this is closely related to that, but a little bit different. I can remember I was a pastor in California, and we had a time, a very prolific and well-known author come and speak to us at the church where I was working. And I don't remember if he had a topic he was talking about, or I don't remember how we got onto this, but he was talking about how important he thought it was that we have an established time for, I don't know if he called it a quiet time, but a time of worship and study and I don't remember the language he used, but communion with God. And what he was stressing is how important it is that you make an appointment with God for a certain time of the day, and that you keep that appointment. And his argument for, and don't be late, don't be late to it. His argument for making the appointment, keeping the appointment, and not being late is because, well, look at our everyday life with one another. Look how disrespectful it is if you are late to an appointment with another human being. Well, if it's disrespectful in relationship to one of my friends or acquaintances here, a fellow human being, how much more is God worthy of our respect? And so just in our own, state of consciousness, just in our own understanding of God, it's important that we not be late and hold ourselves to not being late so that we train ourselves to have due respect for God. Well, I didn't know as much back then as I do now, and I don't think I knew my Bible as well, and there's just, I've learned a lot in the meantime. But even in my relatively immature and naive and ignorant state back then, something about that whole argument just didn't make any sense to me. And basically what bothered me about that is, I'm not stupid. I recognize that God is not like just my other friends. I mean, if I have a flat tire on my way to an appointment with a friend, I owe them an explanation, because they don't know that I had a flat tire. They're finite. They're ignorant of all kinds of things in life. They have no way of knowing, and therefore I owe them an explanation out of respect for them. Do I owe God an explanation if I tripped and fell and cut myself and had to go fix myself before I came to my quiet time? Do I owe God an explanation out of respect for him? Well, I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because he knows good and well exactly what's going on in my life. He's not like my other friends. He transcends reality. He's omniscient. He knows all things. He knows my very heart. And am I supposed to dismiss that from the equation when I think in terms of relating to God? Am I supposed to forget that he's omniscient? Am I supposed to forget that he transcends all things? Am I supposed to forget that he has all time on his hands, and time is of no special value to him, not being finite like I am? Do I forget all those things? Or is it okay to take those into account, to take those into consideration when I think about how best to relate to God? I fear that what we do oftentimes when we turn Jesus into my ideal friend is we miniaturize him. You know, we make him finite in a way that he's not finite. We limit him in a way that he's not limited. We restrict him and bound him when he's in ways that he's not bounded and restricted. And I don't see that as a virtue. I don't see anything positive about that. I think that's a bad thing, a negative thing, not a positive thing.
You know, there was a place when you were talking, Jack, that I just kind of got my hackles up, and I'm going to tell you what that is. You said, well, I'm not stupid. It isn't that I would think that having an appointment with Jesus, seems like a stupid idea, I think was the implication. And
I'm sorry, say that again. What did you think I was saying?
You were talking about this person that came and lectured, this well-known Christian, and he said that you need to make an appointment with Jesus and, you know, keep that appointment. And at some point in that discourse, you said, well, I'm not stupid. I know that Jesus isn't like other people. But that was my point earlier, Jack, is maybe I am stupid. Maybe a lot of us are stupid, because we really do minimize Jesus. We make him into somebody who is kind of like ourselves. But actually, I don't think it's stupid. I just think it's the way we've been taught. It's kind of what we've been, a place we've found ourselves in as a result of a lot of teaching put together. And it's really hard, like I said earlier in the program, to keep using our brains and to keep thinking, is this really what Jesus is about? And it's really hard to pull ourselves out of the mainstream of teaching and say, and ask questions like, is having a relationship with God about this kind of personal, intimate friendship with Jesus? It's just a question that people aren't necessarily asking, so it's easy for us to fall into line with that. It's much harder for us to say, wait a minute, is this what it's about? In fact, it almost seems treasonous. It almost seems like a betrayal of our faith to say, is this about a relationship with Jesus in the sense of him being my intimate friend, like a daddy whose lap I can climb on, like a husband whose heart I can share with? And in a sense, Jack, God is that person. He is a person who is my most intimate, because he understands my heart. He isn't my best buddy in the sense that he gives me everything I want. And I think that's the distinction that we're making today. And that's, and it isn't, he isn't my buddy in the sense that I always feel good with him. In fact, he wants so much for me to have a heart that's defined by goodness, that's defined by righteousness, that's defined by holiness, that very often it doesn't feel good to be in relationship with him. It feels challenging. It feels difficult. It's stretching. Growing up is a very, very hard task. And I have to honor and respect and look up to and know this God and trust this God who is creating a lot of havoc in my life in order to grow me up. And I would say as a result of that, that I've gone through for lots of years, I now have a great deal of comfort in my relationship with God because I believe more than I ever have that he has good in mind for me. And that is a solid, good, very comforting foundation for me. I don't think, but I think that a lot of people think about Jesus as being comforting, and it doesn't have a substantive foundation. It's got this sense of, I just hope that Jesus will give me the money I need or the parking spot I need and or the groceries will be at the store or I'll have enough stuff in my cupboards to make dinner. I hope that Jesus provides those things for me and that will give me comfort. That's a very different comfort than what I'm talking about.
Right.
Are you with me?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I guess I wasn't for a second wanting to imply that there's anything stupid about the person who wants intimacy with Jesus. What I meant by that was we always live with this tension whenever we try to have a personal relationship with Jesus in the way that we are encouraged by much Christian culture. There's always a tension that we experience, and that is So let's take prayer, for example. We're encouraged to take our concerns to God. Well, you know, most of us have felt the tension of that sometimes. As we begin to launch into an explanation of what my problems are, it dawns on me, well, actually, God, you probably know better than I do. What am I telling you for? That's the tension that I'm talking about. And I think there are people, maybe I'm making all this up, but I think that there are people who would encourage us, no, forget who God is. Forget that he's omniscient. Forget that he knows all things. Forget that he has all those abilities. He's really only important to you if you shrink him down to size and he can become like a good friend on the other side of the table having coffee with you where you pour your heart out to him. I mean, what good is God if you can't pour your heart out to him? I think I can hear people saying that. And what I'm saying is I always felt a tension there, and I've come over the course of years to realize that there's not even anything valid about the statement that God loses all his value to me if I don't shrink him down to size and make him just another good friend who's always there and I don't need to talk to on the telephone. He's just I have immediate access to him, so he's the best friend you could ever have. I think there are people who would like to think of God or Jesus in terms that make that his only function in my life, the only reason he's valuable to me. And to that I'm saying, boy, we have something really wrong if that's the only value he is to me.
I like the distinction you made that we have made him that be the only value he has to us or the biggest value, because it is true that we do have direct access to him, and that he pouring out our hearts to him is a wonderful thing to be able to do. I can talk to him. I can request of him. I can hurt with him. I can know that he hears me. And that is comforting, to know that he exists and that I am important to him. But I think the way that we shrink him down is that becomes his final and biggest role in our lives, rather than, again, him being the king, him setting up the standards, him deciding what reality is about and teaching us about that reality through the circumstances in our lives.
I'm just thinking of contrast how there may be some friend that I have where I'm really bothered by something in my life, the way somebody's treating me, for example. And I sit there over coffee talking to them, complaining about these other people, talking about how unjust they've been to me, talking about how I hope they get theirs. I hope this happens to them, and here's how I'm feeling, and here's how I'm thinking. And all the time justifying myself. I mean, it's just some tremendous exercise in self-justification and just that, self-justification. And the right kind of friend might just listen to me. And they might even encourage me in my self-justification. Yeah, Jack, that's right. You're in the right and they're in the wrong. And boy, you are really a victim of them and their attitudes and so on. And you're really right, Jack.
That's the right kind of friend?
No, it's not. But we
a particular kind of friend might do that.
That kind of relationship where that can happen. Well, we could turn Jesus into that, I suppose. And so that my friends could be these grand self-justifications as I kind of chat along with Jesus, my friend. But if Jesus is the real Jesus, sooner or later I begin to realize what I'm doing, and Jesus is not supporting me in this. Jesus is not going along with the self-justification garbage that I'm entering into, and I begin to feel my own guilt, my own blame, my own inadequacy, my own weakness, my own moral failing, and I eventually kind of melt into, forgive me, this is ridiculous, this is silly what I'm doing here, Jesus. I know how I need to respond, I know how I should look at this thing. That would be a real Jesus that I'm relating to, I think.
Jesus, and who in this situation is teaching me the truth about myself, rather than me continuing to be self-deceived and thinking that all these people are really bad and I'm really quite the great guy, or that they're all to blame for things and I don't hold any responsibility.
Right.
Jesus, who wants me to learn about reality, is going to help me look at my true guilt in a situation, help me take on the responsibility for my part in what's going on, and help me see that I am not better than all these people that I'm talking about.
Exactly. And that's at the heart of what I'm getting at. If we're creating Jesus in my image, then he becomes just an enabler to my own self-justification in one way or another. If we're dealing with the real Jesus, he's my king, he's my Lord, he's the one who demands my sanctification in the final analysis. He's the one who's going to demand that I enter into the kingdom of God prepared to be there. And so he wants me to learn and to be wise and to come to some kind of self-knowledge and self-understanding, then that's a real relationship with the real Jesus who's really there.
And it's a real relationship that doesn't necessarily feel peaceful.
Right.
Doesn't really have a sense of comfort to me in the sense that it feels good. Again, it may be a very challenging kind of relationship.
Right.
A very hard kind of relationship. And it is personal in that sense, but it's not personal in the sense that it always gets me what I want when I want it.
Right.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
Okay, can we go on here some? And last week we talked about Jesus as the Messiah, and that's the same as Jesus as the Christ. He is the King to whom I must bow and to whom I must be obedient.
Right.
Is that a pretty good summation of that?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Okay, I listened. Okay, so can we go on to talk about Jesus, the Son of God?
Okay. Well, basically, to call Jesus the Son of God is to say the same thing as to call him the Messiah or the Christ. He's the King. That's more controversial, however, because we have grown accustomed, I think, to thinking of Jesus' title, the Son of God, as being a way of calling him God Jr. He is God. He's derived from God and is God, and has his very being come from the source of God himself, so that he has a divine being in every bit the same sense as God does. Now,
you know, I find that very hard to understand, Jack, because you find that hard to understand. For example, when he was on earth, he talked about being in service to God, that he did his Father's will.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a real distinction between himself and his Father. And I think about a Father as being bigger and better and stronger and wiser than the Son. The Son is kind of a junior guy. He doesn't know as much. And so that's kind of my picture. And it's really hard to get around that he is one and the same with God.
Well, let's talk about the biblical picture, the New Testament conception itself. I think the New Testament conception itself is that there is a distinction between Jesus and God, his Father, but that Jesus is God having become man. And having become man, the man that Jesus is subservient to the Father, is obedient to the Father, does the will of the Father, is lesser than the Father, is not equal to the Father. This is a creature. This is a human being, a human man who must live in the light of the truth revealed by the Father and be obedient to the Father and so on. And that's certainly the portrait of Jesus that you get in the Gospels. This is a human being being obedient. But it's not just any old human being. It's not just an ordinary human being. Unlike you and me, who are merely creatures, Jesus was that creature, what the New Testament calls the firstborn of all creation, was that creature who had a unique relationship with God in that he was the creature that God became. Now, that's a difficult concept as well. I mean, what exactly does it mean for a transcendent God who's the author of all of existence to actually become a part of the existence that he's the author of? And I don't know that we can really adequately understand that. In my mind, the best analogy for that would be, let's say I were to author a novel, and for some reason I decided in this novel to put myself into the novel, to write myself in. Well, the only way I could really enter into the world of the novel itself is if I create a character in the novel that just is me. And I could do that. I mean, I could imagine doing that. I think that's how I conceive of the relationship between Jesus and God, is that God, who is the author of all of reality, this reality that we're a part of, and we're all characters within that reality, Jesus is a character within that reality, but unlike me, Jesus was the character in that reality that God created to be him, to be God himself. It doesn't make him any different than me inside the novel, but he has a very one-of-a-kind relationship with the author of the novel.
So I'm feeling kind of dumb in asking this question, but I'll ask it anyway, hopefully. I remember in school, I used to always raise my hand. I was the kid in class that always did that. And I always thought I was asking dumb questions. But very often I'd have people come up to me after class and say, I'm really glad you asked that question, Christine, because I was afraid to ask it. I thought I'd look really dumb. So I've always gotten the opportunity to look dumb for other people. So here we go again. So what's different now about Jesus, is this true, that he's no longer that man? He is now transcended his human form, and he is again God.
No, I don't think so. I think he became man to remain man eternally, everlastingly, and I think he exists somewhere in some form as a human being at this very moment.
And so that also kind of seems like a junior God then.
What do you mean?
Because
by
a man isn't. I'm a man, and Jesus is a man. Although he was an exceptional man, he's still not as high ranking as God.
Yeah, his existence does not...
He's limited.
He's limited and finite, like all creatures are, whereas God is unlimited and unfinite and infinite. Yeah, that's true. In that sense, Jesus is indeed inferior to God. That's true. Jesus, the man, is not
God, the
ontologically
infinite.
The peer.
Oh, don't
of
say
God,
ontologic. I don't know what that means.
In terms of his being, in terms of his existing nature, he has the same sort of existing nature that I have. Now, with one qualification, he, I think, has already entered into his glorification, and we have not. I still live in this fallen, corrupt, dying body that I have right now. One day I'm going to inherit a body that will not be corruptible. I think the resurrection accounts are trying to suggest to us that Jesus has already inherited his incorruptible body. When he was raised, he was not just resuscitated to the same old body he had before, but actually was resurrected to new life, to the resurrection life, to the everlasting life of the kingdom of God, and he's entered into that state of existence already. But it's still a human, it's still a created state of existence. It's not the divine state of existence in itself.
So the question has to come to mind, why did God do it this way? Why did he make himself into a man and come into our reality?
Well, I don't know that we have an answer to that question.
I thought I had an answer, and I was asking the question.
Well, what do you think is the answer?
That he would understand us and let us know that he understood us because he'd been in the same reality as we are in.
Okay.
I don't know. There's a verse somewhere, I think, in Hebrews that talks about him understanding You can probably quote it better than I.
Yeah, that's in the context of explaining how he's qualified to be our high priest. And that's true. That's a very important theme in Hebrews, that why could Jesus function? I mean, the whole argument there is the book of Hebrews is written because the Jews that had become Christians but are beginning to rethink this whole thing and beginning to leave their Christianity and go back to their ancestral Judaism, Paul, I think, is writing the letter, and he's saying to them, look, their argument is, Jesus, he was just a human being. He can't really be the Messiah sent from God because, you know, he was just a human being just like you and I. And the whole thrust of the early part of the book of Hebrews is to say, yes, he was a human being just like you and I, and don't you get it? He had to be, because if he hadn't been a human being just like you and I, he wouldn't have been qualified to play the role that God had given him, namely to be our high priest. So in order to be our high priest, he had to experience what we experienced and fully participate in human experience and have that be his own experience. Otherwise, he couldn't represent us to God because he wouldn't have been one of us. The argument is that a high priest's function is to be taken from among men to be appointed by God to enter into the presence of God and represent men to God and represent God to mankind.
So the equation wouldn't have worked if he hadn't really been a man.
If he hadn't really been a man, exactly.
So that really is the answer, isn't it?
Yes. I thought you were asking a different question.
I was, but this is a better answer.
Okay. Yeah. We could ask the further question, well, why bother to have a high priest at all? That is, why bother to have a reality that you create where it's even necessary to have a high priest? And to those questions, we don't really get answers. You know?
Oh, Jack, you're thinking beyond me. I wasn't thinking that
okay.
one either.
Okay.
I was thinking more of the experiential side of life. Why would we need Jesus to experience life with us? And I think that definitely gives me comfort that Jesus understands and knows life the way I do. In one sense, it's comforting. In another sense, it isn't very, because he was a perfect man. He was not born of the same genes as I am. He had God genes, and I don't have those. Does that make sense?
Yeah, although I think I'd want to correct that. I mean, I grew up with the notion that the incarnation for God to become man meant that God came down and he took on a man suit. And he wore manness on the outside, but inside he was God. And he'd come across a lake that needed to be walked across, and he'd rip open his man suit, and out would come the power and majesty and glory of God, which permitted him to walk across the lake. And then he got to the other side and covered up again and just pretended to be a man. And then you'd come across some water that needed to be turned into wine, and he'd rip open his man suit, and there, lo and behold, God, who can do anything, could turn this water to wine. And he did that, and then he'd cover up again. That was my childhood conception of the
incarnation. Well, that kind of sounds kind of silly, but it's kind of the sense that I have.
Yeah.
Is, there's certainly something more that he has than I have.
Right. And where that becomes important in our conception of Jesus is then when we ask ourselves the question, how should I live? We look at Jesus and we say, well, look at the way Jesus lived. And the first question that comes to mind is, well, yeah, but look what's under the man suit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course he lived that way, but I'm not God. You can't expect me to live that way. Mm-hmm. And that's where our misconception becomes really deadly, because I think, in fact, what we are invited to recognize is Jesus was fully man. And when he lived the impeccable life that he lived, he wasn't living a life that was out of reach to us in my humanity. Now, that's still true that he was different from me and that he was not sinful. He didn't have a propensity to sin, and I do have a propensity to sin. But he wasn't doing anything that was somehow superhuman when he lived that impeccable life.
But this is what he got from the beginning, is he understood, even as a little boy, who God is.
Right.
He got it. He understood it. And so he could have all his actions, all his behavior be in line with this ultimate understanding of who God is and the value of God. Now that is, Jack, what we spend our lives trying to figure out.
Right.
We really lack it. It's a huge lack.
Yeah.
If we got it, if we really got it to the depth that he gets it, then we could live a life like he did.
And we can even go in one step further. Not only did he have that wisdom, but he had a thirst to gain it, and a thirst to understand it, and a thirst to respond to it, whereas we have an allergy to it. We run the other direction. We hate God, really, until we are... our minds and hearts are turned, and we head back the other direction.
But we never get to a place like he is.
No, never.
To really get that, we could live like him, but that's not going to happen. We're never really going to get that. We're sinful people who are headed in our own direction, who have a very, very difficult time understanding God's values and what's good. We don't get it. We have to be retaught it over and over and over again.
Right, yeah. But you see what difference it makes to think of Jesus facing the temptations that he faced, and through a certain understanding and through a certain kind of wisdom, he said no to evil and said yes to good. I don't do what Jesus did, but I could do what Jesus did. That is, it's not impossible for me to do that. It's just not my nature. It's just not my tendency. But if I can study and understand and come to terms with the psychology of Jesus' obedience, the psychology of Jesus' obedience is one day going to be mine. That's how I'm going to think. That's how I'm going to look at life. I'm going to look at life through those innocent and pure perspectives and beliefs that Jesus had. And so to understand them is to understand what I will be one day and what I can be.
But I'm blocked from it at this point because I am a sinner, and I will never see that clearly.
Right.
So we're not saying we can attain to this level of Jesus, and that's what our goal is. Well, yeah, our goal is to keep working toward understanding what Jesus understood, but we're never going to fully get it. Our sin is this big, huge thing right in the middle of our path,
yeah.
And we'll never get it.
But what blocks me from it is not that I'm a human and he's God. What blocks me from it is that I'm a sinner and he was not.
Yes.
And that's an important distinction.
It's a very important distinction. Okay, let's go on to the Son of Man. In what way is Jesus the Son of Man?
I don't know if we'll have time to finish this, but let me at least get started. That comes out of the covenant that God made with King David back in Israel. In 2 Samuel chapter 7, the prophet Nathan comes to David, and speaking for God, he says, David, you're going to have a son, and you're going to have a child, and I am going to be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. And then he goes on to make a promise about the everlasting rule of David's son. David's seed is what it's called. That language, I will be a father to him and he will be a son to him, I think is the basis upon which the title the Son of God comes. Now,
Son of God or Son of Man?
Well, both. Because I would argue that Son of God, Son of Man, and even the more common term, just the Son that you find in the Gospels, that they all mean essentially the same thing. The operative term in all of them is the phrase the Son. So the Son, there's the Son, which is that Son that was promised in the Davidic covenant, the covenant God made with David. The Son of God is the Son who is sent from God, and the Son of Man is the Son who is taken from among men to be the Son. But the operative term in all of those is the Son. And what does that mean? Well, it basically means the one who is going to rule as king in the eternal kingdom of God. So it really is a synonym for the Christ, the Mashiach, the Messiah. It's really not a different title. It's just another title for the same role that Jesus plays, another term for the same title.
So all these titles, Jesus the Messiah, Jesus the Christ, Jesus the Son of God, Jesus the Son of Man, and Jesus the Son, are just all different ways to understand Jesus from different perspectives. They seem confusing to me, Jack. It seems like, but I think part of the confusion is just not understanding some of the historical context of the Bible.
Exactly, that's the problem.
And if we were in that culture, in that context, 2,000 years ago, it would be very commonplace for us.
Right. For example, it's if you look at the pagan, the heathen literature of the same time, the kings of Babylon and the kings of Egypt and so on were typically called the son of some god. And what they meant by that is really nothing more complicated than the god had invested his authority in that human being so that human being was the visible manifestation of their authority and their rule. Well, that's what God is saying to David. Okay, I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to do. You know, like the claim of the king of Babylon is that Marduk has imparted his authority to, you know, Nebuchadnezzar or whoever the king is, and has invested his authority in him. Well, I, the true God, the God who really is there, I'm going to do that. I'm going to appoint a human being who is going to represent me to the whole world and all the nations. My authority is going to be invested in him, and he will literally rule on my behalf. Well, that's what Paul describes Jesus. He's the visible image of the invisible God. The invisible God, who has all authority, is going to actually focus his authority and locate his authority within the creation in a human being. Ultimately, we know that's Jesus, who's the only one who really can truly make a valid claim to having the authority of God himself focused in him. But that's exactly the claim being made. Jesus is going to be visibly the king who literally rules with the very authority of God himself, even though he's a human being. Well, the term that is meaningful in the ancient world for describing something like that relationship is to call that one the Son of God. And so that's what Jesus did when he sent Nathan to David. He said, I'm going to have this kind of relationship with your child, David. I will be a father to him and he will be a son to me, in the sense that we all understand that. That is, he's going to inherit my power. I'm going to pass my power onto him, in the sense of authority. I'm going to pass that authority on to him. So that's where the title is coming from, and that's what it means.
We are really at a disadvantage, aren't we, that we're not in that culture 2,000 years ago, and it takes just a whole lot of work to understand the Bible from that perspective. And I'm, as I'm listening today, I'm once again encouraged to think about that culture when I understand the Bible, and not to come from this culture, because this culture isn't very helpful to me.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah, I mean, what a son means in our culture is somebody who was born of my body, and that's not at all what's going on there.
Well, it's the opposite.
Yeah, really, yeah.
So no wonder I'm confused. I have a right to be confused.
Right, right. Yeah.
What I've liked about today, Jack, is that for the first time, I think I understand this concept of Jesus as God and Jesus as man, in that I remember having a big conversation with a friend of mine several years ago about what it meant to have Jesus be here on earth and how he was the same and how he was different from me. So don't think in 30 seconds that we have left I can put that in a nutshell, but I'm really thankful for getting that today.
Good.
Over the years, the teachers of McKenzie Study Center have offered many classes, from studies in the book of Romans and Revelation, to a biblical view of history and culture, to sexuality and relationships. McKenzie has also presented conferences ranging on topics such as education, evolution, and the arts. Most of the lectures and discussions are available on tape and can be purchased for a modest fee. McKenzie also has a tape catalog to help you make your choosing easier. To order tapes or get a copy of the catalog, call McKenzie at 541-485-4801. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
So Jack and I have done some talking about how do we ask people for money, since both of us, as you know, are not very good at doing that. One of the things that Jack has been very adamant about is that we don't kind of manipulate people, that we don't set them up, that we don't try to make you guys feel bad or feel something in order to push you to contribute to the program. And one of the ways that we're trying not to do that is to combine asking for your prayer, asking for your letters, and at the same time, asking for financial support. But Jack, today I'm going to break that rule, because we got a letter in the mail that combined those two, and it's a good letter, and I'd like to read it.
Okay.
Dear Christine and Jack, I continue to build my Sundays around your programs, and I continue to tape on Sunday and play back several times during the week until the next Sunday. Also, I have written pages to you about almost every Sunday's program. I never seem to get them typed and sent off to you. Just to hear you absolutely echoes my thoughts, especially what Jack says through your questions to him, Christine, in God's Word. God bless you both. I feel very blessed to be in the ground floor of your programs. I will try to send $25 per month, and I pray that your other avid listeners, at least 50 others, will do the same. Just send that reminder envelope each month. Thank you for your wonderful program. Pretty encouraging, isn't that, Jack?
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, we really do love receiving these letters. And we don't receive tons of them. We would like more to get your feedback, to get your questions, to get your thoughts. And I'd also like to echo what this woman said. We do need your gifts, your financial gifts. And if 50 people gave us $25, that would carry us for a month. So if this program is beneficial to you, please send your financial contributions. We sure can use them.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie,
it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.